Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Tuesday, July 29th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Healing Relationships, a Central Theme, Session 2 of Healing the World, Ideas / Perspectives from Luther and the Lutheran Tradition. Presented by Daryl Janik, number J-O-D 2003-02. Let's listen in.
And I'm Daryl Jodak, and we're discussing tonight healing relationships, a central theme. Central theme, I mean both central for healing the world and central in the Lutheran tradition. Happy kind of correspondence there. So the larger topic for the week is healing the world, ideas, perspectives from Luther and the Lutheran tradition. What we're going to do tonight is to try to talk about an aspect of the Lutheran tradition again that's not been given a lot of attention. Yesterday when I talked, as many of you were here, I tried to talk about a particular concept of God and how a particular image of God was part of the Lutheran tradition. An image of God that's helpful for healing the world, and then talk some about the understanding of creation as an ongoing activity of God, rather than a once and for done, well time done event, as another important ingredient in thinking about a framework in which we can talk about healing the world. And tonight I want to pull up another dimension of the Lutheran tradition, which I think is also important for healing the world and gives us some insights into it. It's a little odd to be around Lutherans a lot because they sometimes form a kind of in-club. I was in Chicago once for 2 days talking with five people about a project we were going to do, and four of the people happened to be Lutherans. And then one non-Lutheran was there. The end of the second day after, Phil Hefner turned to me and said, "Oh, do you know Larry Rasmussen?" I said, "Oh, sure, I went to school with him." The non-Lutheran turned on his heel and said, "Huh, Lutheran mafia," and he walked off. And I used to
hope he didn't leave.
No, he didn't leave. It was a pretend upset, okay? Very much later in my life, I got involved with Jewish-Christian relations, and I was sitting talking to a Jewish rabbi, and he was saying, "Oh, do you know so-and-so?" And I said, "Yes, I met that person. Oh, do you know so-and-so?" And then a friend of mine who was on the faculty who was Jewish said, "Oh, we call that playing Jewish geography, trying to figure out who you know and who you're related to and who you've met and so on." So Lutheran mafia or playing Jewish geography is probably some of the same thing in different contexts. I grew up on a farm, and one of the things that happened to me when I was first teaching is that someone walked up to me in a classroom building and said, "Do you know anything about John Deere tractors?" And I said, "A little bit." And I said, "Why do you ask?" And the person said, "Well, 40 miles out of town here, I've got a Christmas tree farm, and I've got a John Deere B tractor, and it's not working. Can you fix it?" And so I said, "Well, let's try." So on a Saturday, I went out with him, and I fixed the tractor, and he got on, and he drove it around his 20-acre patch, and he hopped off, and he said, "You're the first PhD I ever met who knew anything." So my farming background has been important in my life. And it'll come up again tonight, so I'm just warning you that there's a little bit of peasant imagery that'll be coming up as we go along tonight. What I want to say is that that for Luther and when his successors understood him, for his successors, that there is a kind of assumption that undergirds all of the theology and all of the things that are said. And that assumption is very often not named. The assumption is that that relationships are fundamental, and that human beings are formed and shaped by their relationships. Now, if we think about that in relationship to our contemporary context, it's out of sync with some of the things that are normal assumptions in our society. Well, let me just take one and talk about it a little bit in terms of the relationship between the assumptions that operate in our society and the assumptions that are operating with regard to Luther and to the Lutheran tradition. One of those assumptions that operates in ordinary society in America is what I would put together in the term individualism. Now, that's a term that can be used in different ways by different people. So what I mean by individualism is the notion that a human being can be whole and complete in and of oneself. The notion that a human being can be whole and complete in and of oneself. And along with this is the notion that relationships are temporary. Relationships are something one enters into when it's convenient, one enters into when it is satisfying, one enters into when you need it for some reason or another, and when they stop being satisfied or they stop being convenient or whatever, you just disengage from the relationships. Now, the book Habits of the Heart, written by five different sociologists, Robert Bellow, which is the most famous of them, diagnosed all of that and did interviews and so on. It's all documented there. So if, now using my peasant background of simple pictures, if I were to think about the self under that image of individualism, I think of the self as a billiard ball with an extendable hook. And a billiard ball that when it's convenient, the hook comes out and you hook up to somebody else for a little while. When it's not convenient anymore, you pull the hook back in and you're a billiard ball again, whole, complete, in and out of oneself. And it seems to me that that's the typical assumption that operates in our society. Now, by contrast then, the assumption that operates for Luther is that human beings are formed and shaped by their relationships. I'm going to get to an image for that too, but bear with me for a moment. It's easiest, I think, for us to begin to understand this if we think about the role of parents in our lives. Not that that's the only place it happens, but it's an easy way to think about it. That if a parent, for example, has an image, let me put it another way, that I as a child, my image of myself is very much shaped by what I see mirrored in my parents. So if my parents look at me with an extended view of who I am and who I can be, very often I grow into that extended view. My self expands to fill with expectations. On the other hand, if a set of parents looks upon me in a belittling way, my sense of self shrivels. The belittling is actually a pretty good image for what's going on. It has the effect of diminishing my sense of self. Now, of course, it's not only parents that are involved, because teachers have this role, mentors have this role, other adults have this role, peers have this role. A lot of different relationships are forming and shaping my sense of myself. And of course, it's also not true that these are absolutely determinative, because I can respond in different ways to that forming and shaping. But if I were, for example, to rebel against my parents, I would still be shaped by the relationship, because I rebel against this relationship rather than some other relationship. Or I rebel against these parents for doing this or that rather than some other parents for doing this or that. I would be still shaped by the relationship. So this is not only true of children, it's also true of adults. that adults are formed and shaped by the relationship. And as far as Luther is concerned, this is true for our relationships with other human beings, but it's also and emphatically and most exaltedly so in terms of relationship with God. The relationship with God forms and shapes a person to so that one can say that if person X has a restored relationship with God, they are in some sense a different person from what they would be apart from that restored relationship. That it is so significant that it makes a person a different person. Now, last February, a man by the name of Tom Christensen from Capital University was visiting Gustavus, and we were sitting with a small group, and he's a philosopher. He's very interested in some of these questions. And he said, now, if we think about this concept of self, it's related, what image could we possibly have for it? And the one that I came up with is, and maybe you can find a better one for me, but the best one I could come up with was a potato. Now, I don't mean the kind of potato that you find in a grocery store that's been grown to look like every other potato in the grocery store. I mean the kind we used to dig out of the garden. The
volunteers.
Yeah. The knobby, gnarly, bumpy, you know, big potato that has all sorts of knobs and bumps and so on. That's the kind of potato I'm talking about. Okay. Now, my image of a self that has healthy, good relationships with other individuals is that every one of those relationships is like a connection to that self that has pulled the self out in some way, has extended, expanded the self so that it is greater than, different from what it would have been without that relationship. So every bump on that bumpy potato is a relationship that has enhanced, enriched, expanded the sense of self. Now, for Luther, I think this is just an assumption. He's conscious of it. He doesn't talk about it very much, but he's conscious of it because when he runs across philosophers who say something different, he objects to them, and he says, "No, that's not the correct understanding of a human being." So we know that that it was on his mind. It wasn't. Well, I'm not reading something into him when I'm saying that he made this assumption and he took this seriously with regard to human relationship. Now, by the by, this is a kind of footnote. By the by, whenever followers of Luther have missed this, they wound up getting things pretty confused. Because if you miss this, then you have to figure out how you get from faith to something more active or influencing persons, and you wind up putting some kind of obligations back. You have to do this, or you can't do this, or you have to do this, or whatever to shape it. And you get into a new kind of legalism, or some kind of things come apart at the seams theologically in terms of Lutheran tradition. So this becomes a very important thing to recognize. Now, my point with regard to healing the world is that whatever we need to do to heal the world, recognizing the centrality of relationships and the way in which they influence people is an essential part. We might need other things to heal the world, but we can't heal the world without this one in there. And nothing else can kind of take its place. That restoring and healing relationships, relationships of God to human beings, and relationship of human beings to human beings, and relationship of human beings to the earth is core, central, and important. I have another farm imagery for all of this, and that is, and this shifts quite a bit. I don't know if you've ever seen a bean plant come out of the ground. It's all the leaves are kind of tucked in like this, and it's bent over. It bends over as it pushes through the surface of the ground. And it's just this odd shape, kind of upside down J is what it is. Okay. Now, it seems to me that there's another way of talking about the self, and I don't know how to relate this to the potato, but anyway, bear with me. That the self is so turned in on itself in Lutheran theology, so kind of all tucked in like this and all kind of turned in on itself, that it's incapable of interacting with the world around it. And that part of the grace of God is the grace of the of like sunshine that enables the leaves to open and the leaf and the plant to open up, and open up in the sense of being open to listen to other human beings. You have to switch now back to human beings from being plants. Listen to other human beings, open to in the sense of being able to serve other human beings, open to in the sense of being able to interact positively and well with the surrounding environment. So that's another image I like to use. And only an unfurled plant can participate in healing the world. If it's all like this, it's in a world of its own, and it's not going to participate in actively helping to heal others in the world. Now, the Bible has some images for this as well, and the images, one of the most striking images that one finds in the Bible is that is of a person that's not healed, is dead. Namely, that a human being can be breathing in and out, but if that human being is not related, that human being is as good as dead, according to the Bible. Or in terms of Jesus' imagery, empty. You know, whitewashed on the outside, but empty on the inside is another way, another image that one finds in the Bible for this lack of it. Now, one of the things that I've been enjoying and observing is how closely connected Brad Beenow's discussions each morning are to what I'm trying to do. And so at this point, the analysis of what it means to be curved in, to be broken relationship, and so on, is all going to be worked out in his class. And we'll go on to do some other things. Okay? Now, the second place at which our society seems to have a different view from the world than the one that I'm trying to express. And the one I'm trying to express is that relationships are fundamental, that relationships are what basic to reality. Another thing that happens in our society is that the world is looked at differently from this. That is the natural world. The natural world tends to be looked at, well, we could fill in a whole variety of things. It tends to be looked at as if it was isolated, separate things, pieces of matter, pieces of material that only move if something moves them. We tend to look at the world as having, simply being there as natural resources. I mean, even that term natural resources, that phrase natural resources suggests that it's there for us to consume or to do something with. We tend not to look at the natural world in related through the imagery of relationships. I'd just like to suggest that contemporary science is catching up with theology, if I can put it that way. Contemporary science is taking relatedness far more seriously than it used to do, Newtonian science and so on. Contemporary science does this, and I just want to hint at some ways in which it does it. For example, when you get to quantum theory and quantum mechanics, you probably all know about the experiments where you send a beam of light through two slits that are like this, and then you have a screen on the other side, and that's like a photographic screen, and it will tell you where the light hits. Well, if the light beams are going through slits like this, you'd expect them to be right beyond the openings. But what happens, because light acts as a wave as well as a particle, is that you get a series of bars on the photographic paper on the other side of those two slits. It's come through the slits as waves instead of particles. Well, that's all very commonly known. But if you were to take that and you were to emit just one electron at a time, it would look like it's going through both slits. So if you got really curious about that, and you were to try to measure which slit it was going through, it would revert and start acting like a particle and go through only one slit. Okay. So how it is behaving is influenced by what kind of relationship the viewer has to it. Okay. That blows our minds. I mean, it's really kind of weird to think about. And so the act of measuring it influences how it acts, the kind of relationship that's there. Think about the whole ecology thing and the way in which we have to think very carefully about how something exists as part of an ecological system. It's not by itself. It exists as part of an ecological system. And if the system dysfunctions, the plant or the animal is jeopardized by that, right? Relationships are essential to the reality of that fish or that bird or that plant or whatever. And so we can go on talking about the importance of relationships in science as being recognized evolution as a theory simply says that something is influenced by its surroundings. You know, you've got a beak on a bird that develops in an odd way. It develops in an odd way because it needs that odd beak in order to get to the fruit that's available in its environment. It's formed and shaped by its relationships. Now, I'm not saying, of course, that this is exactly the same as happens to human beings in a relationship or on the same level or the same profundity or anything, but it does suggest, it seems to me, that what Luther was assuming about human beings can also be applied broader than human beings to the natural world as well, and for us to begin to think about what those implications might be. Now, I'd like to introduce another term at this point, and that I think will be helpful in trying to pull this together a little bit. That's a term that's become meaningful to me the last 4 or 5 years, and it's a term, beauty. Now, the person whose definition of beauty I'm drawing on is a man by the name of Alfred North Whitehead. Alfred North Whitehead was a philosopher, lived in the first half of the 20th century, and was very interested in science and so on, and religion, though not probably an Orthodox Christian, but interested in Christianity and religion. And he defined beauty as a harmony in which there is both pattern and novelty. It's a harmony in which there is both pattern and novelty. Pattern and diversity. And if you were to take something that had only pattern and order to it, you'd have monotony. You wouldn't have beauty. Right? If you had only order, you'd have only monotony in the end. If, on the other hand, you had something that had only novelty and no order or pattern, you'd have chaos. So beauty is something different from chaos and something different from monotony. It's taking things that are diverse and so on and putting them together and defining a pattern, a harmony. And this harmony, this beauty, can be more intense if it includes more novelty and diversity within the harmony. Now, if one wants a story to think about what intensity might mean, I heard a story once of a woman who brought her son to a piano concert. And there was a pianist going, the famous pianist going to play. And she's got seats right down in the front row because she wanted her son to see what a great pianist was like, to aspire to be one, and therefore keep taking music lessons, playing the piano, and so on, right? Well, this woman sat down, and her son wanted to wander along around, and so she said, fine, go wander around a little bit. And the curtain opened, and there was the seven-year-old boy sitting at the concert grand piano playing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. She was, of course, mortified. But in the wings of the stage was the pianist, and he saw who the mother was, and he motioned to her, you know, shh, it'll be okay. And then he walked out and he started playing around the boys, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, and introducing all sorts of variations and harmony and complexity to that song, and making it something much richer and more, much less simple than Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. So intensity of beauty is, and it occurs like in a symphony where you've got a theme, yes, that provides order, but you've got all kinds of variations on that theme. You've got all kinds of dissonance becoming harmony or getting resolved into harmony and all of that.
Mozart loved doing that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so if one takes something like this concept of beauty and one applies it to relationships, there are some interesting things that start to happen. I'm trying to think of where I go next in terms of trying to make the point I'm making. If one thinks of beauty not just as visual beauty or as musical beauty, but as narrative, then there starts to be a connection. A narrative is something which has pattern to it. It has a beginning, a middle, an end. It has a resolution. It has a story. It has variations in it. It has dissonance. It has tensions in it that get resolved and so on in most stories. And stories are very, very important to us because stories assure us that there's some kind of meaning in life. I was in New Haven, Connecticut many, many years ago, and the radio station played one of the original 15-minute versions of The Lone Ranger. Now, as a kid...
William Tell Overture.
Pardon me?
The yes. William Tell Overture. You know. It's not The Lone Ranger. It's not The Lone Ranger.
I'm sorry.
It's the William Tell Overture.
Oh!
Yeah. The Lone Ranger
story.
Is the program on
I
the radio.
Know.
That played that
endlessly. Who was that masked man, you know, and he's riding off into the sunset, the Lone Ranger, right? I used to listen to that as a kid, with my ear up against the big console radio in our house and listen to it. But at any rate, this was being played on the radio in Connecticut, and at the end of the 15-minute segment, the announcer came back and he said, notice that I played this 10 minutes earlier than I did yesterday. Because yesterday I played another segment and our switchboard was swamped with calls of people that were late to work because they had to listen to the end of that story in the parking lot before they went into work. Now, there's an interesting power to a story that we're so concerned to find out how it finishes that we'll let ourselves be late to work to hear how it ends, right? That's part of the power of what the pattern is that's there. Okay, now what I'd like to suggest is that the healing of the world requires the creation of beauty in terms of bringing human relationships together into harmony, where conflict gets resolved into harmony, where distance gets overcome into unity. And then I'd like to suggest that what Christianity does for us is to deepen, to intensify, to make more intense the pattern of beauty that we find in our own lives, or can discern in our own lives. And that what God does is to make more intense the beauty that's found in the world. So that the God who's down to earth, working at world in the world behind the scenes, one way to talk about what God is doing is to create beauty and to intensify the beauty that's there in terms of making everything into one story that has coherence and meaning to it. Now, that doesn't mean coming out with monotony. It doesn't mean coming out with uniformity, either with human beings or with regard to the created order, but it does mean finding pattern and harmony that is rich enough and deep enough and encompassing enough to include all sorts of diversity in it. What happens when our understanding of the narrative of our life is too shallow is that it can't take novelty. If my life is run according to the narrative pattern of success, it's not going to be able to handle the death of somebody close to me. Right? The pattern doesn't have enough resilience to do that. It doesn't have room enough for it, you know. And so any kind of pattern that's going to be meaningful religiously has to have room enough in it for our sinfulness, for our evil, that's it, for the evil that's in the world, for the grace of God, for the joy that's in the world, and to pull it together, to see how it somehow pulls together into a pattern of unity. Now, it doesn't mean everything's affirmed in it. It doesn't mean that everything is good, but it means it's pulled together, it's transformed into something which can be a part of that meaningful whole. Now, I want you to talk about only one final thing to say, and that is that Lutherans have been accused, correctly, of being very fond of paradox. That they say, well, it's both this and that. And a very famous paradox, human beings are both justified and sinners. Luther began a treatise on Christian liberty. The Christian is the free lord of all, subject to none. The very next sentence, the Christian is the dutiful servant of all, subject to all, puts the two right next to each other into a paradox, right? Lutherans are full of paradoxes. In fact, a graduating class from a seminary, one person told me, was so tired of hearing from a Lutheran seminary that it wasn't a question of either or both and, that they formulated as the model for their graduating class. It's not a question of either or of both and, but of both either or and both and. That was their slogan, making fun of it. At any rate, it's the reason for paradox is that the fundamental reality has to do with relationships, and that any relationship cannot be described in its uniqueness without using paradox. No person can be defined in their uniqueness without using paradox, sooner or later. If you try to describe to me somebody that you know well, and you start using words, and pretty soon you'll be saying, well, this person is both like this and like that. Well, this person's like this but not like that. You start sorting it out in terms of paradoxes. So what this suggests, it seems to me, that is for the Christian church, for understood in terms of a Lutheran perspective on the Christian church, what's fundamental about Christianity is also not its teachings, as important as those are, but its teachings are like windows through which you're intended to look to see the underlying reality, which is the quality of the relationships that are being affected by those teachings. And if one gets transfixed by the teachings, then one has not got the kind of resilience that's there in order to have beauty, and in order to have healing, and in order to have relationships that grow and change and move and improve and so on. Well, this is a heavy load for a Tuesday evening of a lot of abstract ideas, so I'm going to ask you to help me sort it out. Okay. Yes, go
ahead. I'm back with last night's question now in a better setting, I think.
Okay, I agree it's a better setting.
Okay. Some time ago I began to think about, you know, how the self is self and whole and so forth, and it seems that we say biblically we're created in the image of God. One of the things you have to say is you're created in the image of a triune God. That's how the tradition has understood who God is. And that somehow points then to relationality.
Yeah.
God is fundamentally in the person of the Trinity, relational. And I'm aware a lot of people in the sort of feminist theology tradition, men and women, have been working that theme. But what I'm in search of is there a place in Luther where he more explicitly develops his understanding of the Trinity, and can Lutherans expand on that, or are we sort of tagging along behind some other traditions who are developing that Trinitarian notion more richly?
Yeah. Let me answer in several ways. First is, I don't know what's there in Luther on that particular topic. It would be interesting to look at that more than I've looked at it. So first of all, I don't want to pose as having very much insight there. Secondly, it seems to me that the Trinity plays an important role in Christian tradition, not only in the sense of reminding us of the relatedness of God, also reminding us of the dynamic character of God, that those are essential components in what the Christian tradition means by affirming Trinity, it seems to me. That God is also not a billiard ball, right? Self-contained, static, simple, as opposed to dynamic and so on. And the Trinity, if you have the Trinity there, you also can't forget that God's a little like a potato too. If I really push that image far. Now, I think that there is a good deal to be developed out of Luther with regard to the Trinity, but I'm not sure how much he did it, because it was just not a question on his agenda at the time. It wasn't a matter of controversy. It wasn't a matter of, it was a matter that he shared agreement with the people that were pressing him and raising questions and so on. So he tended to go where the problems were in his writing and in his thinking. And so it might be undeveloped that way. The Finnish folks are Luther scholars, I think, are doing some more with that than has been done in the past. Again, I'm not well acquainted with it. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't speak to that either, but what struck me, if you look not so much at his writings as Luther's life story, that Luther's spiritual journey really began with a hunger to establish a relationship. I mean, the crisis in Luther's life was a crisis of relationship,
right,
in which he felt he had an angry God who rejected him, whom he could never please.
Right.
And that for Luther, the great illumination of the gospel was discovering that at the other end of that relationship was this God of absolute love and acceptance. Mm-hmm. And when that relationship, took on a different, totally different character for Luther, then that began to open him up to have a different kind of relationship to all kinds of other people.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's related to the fact that his home became a, a welcoming place for anybody that walked in the door. There were times when he and Katie had 100 people sitting around the dinner table because you know, Luther wanted to welcome and embrace, at least most of the time. There are other times when he really, you know, he got angry at, you know, at people whose ideas and behavior seemed destructive of relationships.
Let me bounce off of what you said a little bit, okay? Because what you were saying reminds me of something very important. And that is that at the same time we have to be indebted to Luther for these insights that we want to appropriate and to reclaim, like the ones you're talking about, we also have to be aware of the sociological difference between his time and our time. And to some extent, you know, I'm going to oversimplify here, but to some extent in his time was a time in which he lived with at a time when people were rooted in families and rooted in communities and rooted in small towns. We live in a time where people tend to be unrooted and unconnected. So for our day, what I would want to argue is that it's important for us to interpret Christianity in such a way that we see that it's not just about resolving relationships with someone, you know, who looks angry to us or need forgiveness for it, but it's also about establishing connectedness. And that I'm going to add to the definitions of sin that Brad has been working with, that sin is a refusal to acknowledge our connectedness. Sin is a refusal to acknowledge that we're connected with God because we'd rather be God. Sin is a refusal to acknowledge that I'm connected with welfare recipients, a refusal to acknowledge that I'm connected with militant Muslims, a refusal to acknowledge I'm connected with giant sequoias in California, and it's not okay just to, you know, to saw them down at random, and so on and so on and so on. So, while appreciating what he's saying, we also have to kind of extend it and think about it in our setting as moving into also encompassing this acknowledgement of connectedness. Great. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to say that.
Yeah, I want to ask about, you know, I've been disturbed in the Old Testament about, with all the conflict and everything there, the tribal conflict. Is that, do you think, a reflection of some of the uncomfortableness with novelty? And what would did Luther interpret any of that conflict in terms of relationships or the uncomfortableness? Or?
As far as Luther is concerned, you have this sense that this world is full of conflict and this world is full of battles between good and evil and so on. You have this sense that the world is a kind of messy place, right? And so he felt a great deal of kinship with those folks in the Old Testament that needed to struggle with the messiness of their day or the conflicts of their day or whatever. Now, the notion of beauty that I'm working with is, of course, not Luther. This is coming from the 20th century. But it seems to me that what one can see is that God is creating a narrative in the Old Testament through his covenant relationship with people, which somehow can pull in some of that conflict and some of that ambiguity and some of that messiness into a larger coherent story. And part of the grace of God is to make our to allow us to participate in something bigger than ourselves. And then part of what it means to be a person of faith is to be ready to acknowledge all of those relationships and to work at restoring them in such a way that they're healthy and full. I'm not sure if I'm getting to your comment or not.
Partially, I'm just wondering, in Luther's thought, in general, does he think, I mean, that's how he looks at conflict. I mean, is that the Old Testament conflict?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Because just because there's conflict doesn't mean God isn't at work there, behind the scenes.
Yeah, and see, and that's my prejudice, is I think that God isn't at work because there is conflict.
Uh-huh. See, if you allow me to make a comment about a tradition that I respect very, very deeply, so it's, this is not putting it down, but when I talk with Presbyterians, they're the persons who tend to have the most trouble with Luther's concept of God. And they tend to have a great deal of trouble with Luther's concept of God because, and I emphasize this again with all charitableness and respect and so on, they tend to have a great deal of trouble with because they get take a great deal of personal comfort in the assurance that God is making this orderly life, orderly universe, in which everything comes out to serve the good in some way. That God, that there's a harmony, there's a plan for it, and that it's all kind of worked out in such a way that it all makes perfect sense if you were to understand it. I don't think Luther thinks that the world makes perfect sense, even if you understand it. That what gives us comfort in this world is the assurance that God has said, you are my child no matter what. What does not, is not given us to give comfort is to have it all figured out, or to even know that it all somehow makes sense in some kind of order, you know, pattern. It all has a, it all has a plan to it. Now, what I'm arguing is that in some richer sense of pattern, there's a richer sense of pattern that includes diversity, but not in this sense that my Presbyterian friends seem to take comfort in.
Yeah. Maybe I'm a Presbyterian at heart and just tend to naturally emphasize the unity in my thought and haven't looked enough at the novelty and the diversity.
Yeah. I mean, let's just take another example. Was John Calvin and Martin Luther were contemporaries, Calvin, the ancestor of Presbyterians. And when it came to interpreting the Bible, both of them wrote commentaries on many books of the Bible. And for John Calvin, he was fully aware of the diversity of different books in the Bible. And Luther was fully aware of the diversity of different books in the Bible, but Luther celebrated the diversity. Luther said, you always have to remember that Isaiah doesn't talk like Jeremiah, and Jeremiah doesn't talk like Luke, and Luke doesn't talk like Paul, and Paul doesn't talk like John. And you have to remember that, that Psalm, you know, the Song of Songs is written in a particular context of Solomon's day, and they take that historical context seriously, and so on. And Calvin didn't emphasize that at all. What he emphasized was that all the books had one author, the Spirit, and therefore they said all one thing. Now, I think that's indicative of different mentalities.
Yeah.
Right? And for Luther, the diversity was an enriching thing rather than a problem. And that comes through, I think, a little bit in their sense of God as well. Others?
Well, in thinking about healing the world,
yes,
what you're suggesting is that that we see ourselves in relationship to that, and we see the beauty, the pattern of beauty, and that's how we, that's our window, right, and how we look at those things.
And if God is about creating beauty and more intense beauty in the world, then what we're invited to be is co-creators with God. We're invited to be also beauty creators and beauty intensifiers in the world, and that's our role. And that's a role not in the sense of you must do it, but it's a role to which we're invited, you know. God's going this direction, why don't you come on along, Papa?
He releases us to do that.
Releases to do it, yes. Releases and invites.
One of the problems, you know, that kind of arises for us is how do you participate in that kind of thing, you know, where the core values are absent? I think of the example from South Africa, you know, where they came out of the apartheid experience, and Desmond Tutu in his book No Future Without Forgiveness talks about the core concept of Ubuntu, mm-hmm. which was a very deeply held value in the African society. And Ubuntu means we live because of other people.
Right.
And that when they came out of this experience, when Nelson Mandela came out of prison and everybody thought, now you're going to have bloodletting, you know, that value wedded to Christian teaching and Christian belief suggested that even though the whole world thought it was crazy, that they needed to reach out to each other in compassion and forgiveness. There were some hard things that had to happen. There had to be some truth-telling.
Yeah.
There had to be some acknowledgement of responsibility for actions. But ultimately, the goal was forgiveness that could reach out and create a basis for some healing of their society.
See, what I'm saying, as daunting as it is that the role of the church in American society is to create some alternative way of thinking about us as related, which is not present in society. That means that in ways in which we have to take far more seriously than we typically do, that we are a movement out of step with much that happens in this society. And have to be clear about those places where we're out of step. And to be able to find ways to talk about, to provide images for, you know, simple little things like potatoes or whatever, for alternative ways to look at human beings, to look at the relationship to the world, to the relationship to each other and God. We have to create an alternative story, an alternative image, an alternative reality.
Which means that we have to live as a Christian community in an alternative lifestyle. I mean, we can't just live like everybody else and then just talk nice pictures.
Right.
You know, we have to actually incarnate another alternative.
That's right. And that alternative lifestyle can have diverse forms.
Right.
Right. So, I mean,
that's one of the things we should be modeling. You know.
Yeah. I mean, so that part of the problem with alternative lifestyles is that they sometimes get rigidified into a way of being alternative.
Right.
But we need to have a variety of alternatives being practiced in terms of embodying an alternative vision.
The other thing that seems to be necessary is that we need to be open to learn from other peoples around the world, because there are societies in the world that do incarnate that sense of relationship and that sense of responsibility.
Well, they're not very far in our own tradition.
Yeah. But if we think that we're the ones that have the answers and that somehow the world has to be brought around to recognize our wisdom, it's kind of
too far. Right. I mean, we think about it, for example, that there are, I was just reading a story of a small country church where there was a practice in this small country church of the sponsors for the child being baptized standing. And there was a woman who was a single parent and not connected to anybody else that brought her child to be baptized. And so when the pastor called upon who would be sponsored for this child to stand, she stood alone for just a second, and then the whole congregation stood. And there was some sense there that we are connected, and deliberately overcame the disconnection that the society as a whole had put on her for whatever her lifestyle and so on had been up to that point.
There's a comment over there.
Yeah. Okay.
There seems to be, I may be mistaken, but I'm almost feeling like an assumption in here
that we are the one who could be the reconciler, but I see overwhelmingly that we can't be. It's Jesus who's the reconciler. We've been giving the ministry of reconciliation, but he is the one that's in the center of it for reconciling relationships, and that was his purpose for coming.
Yes.
So somehow that needs to be kind of interwoven in here so that we do not forget. It's like he had talked about in his teaching yesterday in relationship to sin, that yes, we want to overcome it, but we can't.
Mm-hmm.
He is the one that overcomes it in us. I'm just bringing that up because and I miss the word Jesus or the name Jesus in there as the reconciler.
Yeah, I simply agree with you. Okay, I'm glad you bring it up.
Just add to that and say some, one of the questions then is, okay, so how does Jesus do that? So how does the atonement work? That's as simple as the question, and then a million volumes written to try to explain it.
Right, that's the search.
Nobody's got the final answer on that, but more recently, people that I've read suggest that it's helpful to move away. Somehow the power of God is at work in the cross and resurrection. How do we define that power? Maybe it's not so helpful to talk about a kind of coercive power that dominates and subdues and so forth, but rather that God's power is relational power, and that Jesus does draw all people unto himself. There's a kind of connected, subsuming, loving, relational dynamic that we can't fully understand, but still is completely real. It's as unpredictable as the particle wave thing, but as demonstrable as that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's, you have to take a different look at how the power is being enacted there.
Well, someone like Jesus is both a reality and a symbol. So if one can take it as a symbol for the moment, not denying reality, but also take it as a symbol, that one of the things that the importance of Jesus symbolizes for me when I'm talking about God is that God works from within. Right? God works from within humanity by becoming a human being and living among us, and not only saving us, but calling us to a fuller humanity than we otherwise express, otherwise live off. And that God, I believe that in Christ, I see God at work beyond where Jesus' name is being named. Again, not denying that reality, that God is at work where Jesus' name is being named, but also not restricting the reality of God to that. And so sometimes when I'm talking about God, I'm trying to talk about reminders that go beyond, that God is at work in the whole world as well as within Christians and so on, in the same way in which God was at work in Christ. But in a way that that we see as Christians more clearly than others might see. So I affirm it, but I also want to see that it's indicative of how God works beyond Christ as well. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That to say it the way I sometimes say it, that when God became man in Jesus, that was typical of the way in which God works. That God continually works through human beings and through the world from within to heal, to restore, to forgive, and so on. And that God's activity is indicated by that. I agree. Thank you for bringing that up. How are we doing time-wise?
20 after.
I'm sorry?
20 after.
20 after? Is that quitting time? Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.